Maximus Live. This is our 44th episode. And we spend this hour together to talk about health and performance optimization for men. I run a performance optimization company called Maximus. You can check us out at MaximusTribe.com. We provide doctor-prescribed, at-home labs, medications, supplements, and coaching as part of a program we call the King Protocol. And we, on average, can double men's testosterone levels safely and effectively. So if you're interested and you are located in California and Florida, we'll be in a bunch of other states soon. But right now we're in California and Florida. You can check us out at MaximusTribe.com. So every week, I like to start out with what we call our weekly unpopular opinion to bring you some interesting science-related facts that are practical and you can apply to your life. And this week's weekly unpopular opinion is that I've talked about on previous shows that most supplements are essentially worthless for boosting your testosterone. But this week, I'm actually going to talk about how they're, in fact, some of them are actually harmful. And the one that I want to talk about in particular is one that a lot of you may be familiar with. In fact, a lot of you may be taking, and that is curcumin. Curcumin is an extract of the root that you may be familiar with, turmeric, which is used in a lot of cuisines, especially Indian and Middle Eastern cuisines, that imparts that nice orange color and flavor. Turmeric is a very commonly used herb for thousands of years, has medicinal qualities. It's most known for essentially being an anti-inflammatory. And so when supplement manufacturers provide an extract of it, which is called curcumin, if you read the reviews, for instance, on Amazon, a lot of people take it to relieve pain. So as opposed to taking an over-the-counter, a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug or an NSAID, like an ibuprofen or Advil or naproxen that you may be familiar with, aka Aleve, a lot of people take turmeric to alleviate chronic pain, arthritis, things of that nature, or to kind of just dampen down inflammation in general. It does work pretty well for that purpose. The downside is, and what a lot of people don't realize, is that herbs, because they have many, many constituents in them, they're not purified, even though curcumin is one of the components to it, it may have other effects besides the anti-inflammatory effect. The one effect that a lot of people are not familiar with is that it basically has an anti-androgenic effect, meaning it counteracts the androgens like testosterone and DHT in men, which is something that you obviously don't want to do if you want optimal hormone functioning. So in fact, there's research that shows, you know, a lot of this is in vitro and in mice, but it does show that curcumin extract lowers testosterone, lowers DHT, and lowers sperm count. So it's almost an anti-fertility kind of supplement. Now, it's unclear if this is a consistent effect in humans, and it's also unclear what's the amount of dosage, because as we say in pharmacology, the dose is the poison. It's not to discourage people from ever taking turmeric. Obviously, like I said, if you're using it for cooking purposes, as you do in traditional cuisines to make curries, for instance, that's probably all right. But if you're taking a very potent turmeric extract that's curcumin, my recommendation is, although not providing medical advice, is it does work for pain. So it may be fine to take acutely, like if you're, you know, you have a temporary injury and you want some anti-inflammatory, anti-nociceptive or anti-pain relieving effects, then great. But you may want to, as a man, not take it on a daily basis for chronic pain because it has this anti-androgenic quality. A lot of folks obviously know that testosterone is sort of the master male hormone, provides a lot of benefits, including increased energy, drive, confidence, increased muscle mass. But people also don't appreciate that testosterone converts to DHT, which is the androgenic hormone. It's more potent in terms of its ability to bind to the androgen receptor. And I call DHT almost the virility hormone. It's what makes men aggressive. It gives you that edge, that competitiveness, that drive, and is also particularly important for libido. So you don't want to squash your DHT. Unfortunately, there are medications out there, finasteride being the most common of those. Finasteride, aka Propecia, is the brand name. which is both used to for BPH in terms of reducing prostate size, but also it's a common hair loss medication. While it may save your hair, a lot of people do develop sexual side effects from it, and so that's why I'm not a fan of it. I don't think it's a smart idea to suppress your DHT. And I've mentioned in previous episodes that topical finasteride does the same thing. It basically squashes your DHT levels, which as a guy you don't want. You want to maintain your virility and your masculinity. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't realize that curcumin does basically the same thing in terms of demolishing your DHT levels. So I always suggest to folks, and I actually tweeted about this today, don't take curcumin on a daily basis. It's probably not great as a guy. Just use it as needed. If you do need something for chronic pain, obviously talk to your doctor, but something that you can consult with them about is something called palmitol ethanolamide, or PEA, which is different than a different PEA. But if you're looking at palmitol ethanolamide, there's a lot of research that substantiates its use for chronic pain. And in my opinion, is a safer over-the-counter supplement to take. If you check out a previous episode, we record these and put them on YouTube, Maximus Live episode 22. At the beginning of that, for the first 5 minutes, I talk specifically about PEA or palmitol ethanolamide and how it works in terms of its mechanisms of action. So check that out as a curcumin alternative. If you've been taking it for chronic pain, I suggest that you take something else that's not going to mess with your hormones.
It's like a little bit of a backstory. I've been kind of on this roller coaster ride of all these different SSRIs that have, you know, like some kind of work, some kind of don't, but long story short, they all kind of have the common denominator of these ridiculous side effects. So like nausea, all just stuff that just doesn't make you feel good. So, sure. And it kind of seems like the kind of, it's very randomized. Like, okay, if a Prozac doesn't work, then let's try a Trinilex. And if a Trinilex doesn't work, we'll just try. It just seems so random, and like the side effects are so bad. I guess my question to you was, from my understanding, 5-HTP doesn't have that many side effects. So how do you feel about getting out of SSRIs and taking 5-HTP instead of those? I know maybe it won't be as effective, but I think, you know, well, yeah, I guess that's my question. Just what are your thoughts on just taking 5-HTP instead of an SSRI?
Yeah. So great question. First of all, really sorry to hear, you know, your unfortunate experiences with SSRIs and psychiatric medication. I know it's the toughest thing in the world when you're dealing with, you know, whatever you're facing, whether it's depression or any other issue, and, you know, you're struggling with that. And then, you know, you're obviously seeking a treatment to, you know, feel better. And then that treatment is causing a whole new host of new problems. I think that's the challenge of psychiatry. Unfortunately, it's still as much of an art as it is a science. The good news is it's getting better. So one of the things that you're pointing out is like, man, this is really trial and error. And, you know, as someone who trains psychiatrists, unfortunately it is. But, you know, there are companies, for instance, now like Spring Health, that are using a more algorithmically driven approach. So there are, for instance, some new genetic tests that are coming out that basically predict your response to an SSRI. And so as opposed to going through a 6 to 8 week trial, which is, you know, common in terms of figuring out if it works for you, they can almost, not exactly, but to a better degree than a coin toss, let's say, predict your response to SSRIs based on some genetic tests. So it's a combination of the genetic test and the drug, and seeing how you can respond, and maybe even suggesting which drugs you may respond better to. I really think that's the future of psychiatry is, you know, we're going to collect a lot of data, not just genetic data, you know, demographic data, symptom data, all kinds of stuff, you know, spit it into an algorithm, and then it'll probably give you probabilities in which, okay, here's this treatment, try this one first, highest probability that's going to work. And it will still be trial and error, but at least it's going to be data-driven trial and error as opposed to totally happenstance. Now, this does happen in the sense that your clinician or your psychiatrist, if it's a psychiatrist that's prescribing it, is basically using their own internal algorithm, right? Like someone who's been practicing like myself for over a decade, you've tried a bunch of stuff and you may have seen hundreds, if not thousands of patients. And so you kind of develop an internal algorithm for, okay, I like you know, sertraline as the first line approach. If that doesn't work, then let's try, fluoxetine or whatever it is that happens. Now, that is a little bit more anecdotal and kind of based on human judgment rather than, you know, a computer judgment. But I do think that's the way that things are going to go. In the meantime, you still got to figure out what to do. So first and foremost, I would say talk to your prescribing provider. Some folks are more or less open to supplements. There is fortunately a lot of research, because SSRIs are not perfect drugs, on essentially adjunctive treatments to SSRIs. So for instance, if you're experiencing sexual side effects due to SSRIs, which are very common, especially in men, they tend to experience delayed ejaculation or what's called anorgasmia, the inability to orgasm. Now, funnily, that could be a bug or a feature in the sense that if you have premature ejaculation, it actually treats that and it makes it better and makes you last longer, which some guys actually enjoy. But on the other hand, if it takes too long, then that's a problem and you're not able to orgasm. So that just depends on the individual more than anything. But that side effect in particular can be ameliorated by taking, you know, a second medication, or for instance, switching to a different class of medications, one class of which is SNRIs, they're serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors. Those tend to not have as much of the sexual side effects. An example of that drug would be Wellbutrin, which is used for depression, but may in fact actually have some sexual enhancing qualities, because norepinephrine is like noradrenaline and kind of gives people an energy boost that some of the other drugs don't have as much. So I would go to talk to them about the particular side effects that you're experiencing. And yeah, you may need to try a different medication or maybe a whole different class of medications for the treatment of depression or anxiety or whatever it is that you're facing. So it may require them to, you know, if you've already cycled through a lot of the SSRIs, going a little bit outside of the box. There are other classes of medications, the SNRIs I mentioned, there are MAOIs, which were more traditionally used, tricyclic antidepressants. There are different medications that have, they have their own side effects, but they may be different than the ones that SSRIs have. So I would say you don't necessarily give up on psychiatric medications altogether. It just may take you a couple more tries than other folks in order to find the right ones. So that's first and foremost. Really work with your provider. Second, you know, I would bring up the question that you have about 5-HTP. So for the people who are listening, 5-HTP is basically the precursor to serotonin. So your body converts tryptophan, which is an amino acid that you get from food. You might have heard, for instance, that turkey is very high in tryptophan, and that's what makes people groggy after Thanksgiving dinner. That's actually not the case. It's because we eat too much. That's what makes you groggy. But tryptophan converts to 5-HTP, which converts to serotonin. So back in the day, some people who, you know, wanted to increase their serotonin would supplement with L-tryptophan. Unfortunately, in like 1989, there was some incident in which there was some contaminated batch of L-tryptophan. A bunch of people died and they pulled L-tryptophan from the market for a long time. It's actually back on the market. You can take it for, you know, supplemental reasons to increase serotonin. A lot of people take it to improve their sleep, for instance, because of that grogginess effect. But you can obviously take the closer precursor to serotonin, as in 5-HTP. The thing I'll share with you anecdotally, 5-HTP is not as side effect free as a lot of people think it is, in that if you take too much 5-HTP, you can actually develop something called serotonin syndrome, which is typically only seen with, ironically, high dose SSRIs, in which more is not always better. And having too high levels of serotonin can actually cause, as to your point, like things like nausea, which is one of the side effects that you're describing, often a classic symptom of excess serotonin, especially if you're particularly sensitive to it. The thing that people don't appreciate is that your GI system or your gut actually has more serotonin receptors than any other part of your body, including the brain. And so when you take things that stimulate the serotonin receptor, it can have gastrointestinal effects. So 5-HTP can also, quite frankly, cause stomach upset, gastrointestinal issues, nausea, just as much as SSRIs can, depending on the dose that you take. So don't assume that just because it's an over-the-counter or herbal supplement that it's necessarily side effect free. And I would say, especially if you're taking an SSRI, you do not want to take the two together, because you're going to get a serotonin boost from both of them through a different mechanism. 5-HTP increases the, well, it's a precursor. You're essentially like loading the top of the funnel, so to speak. So your body's going to convert some of that 5-HTP to serotonin. And then taking an SSRI, which by definition is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, is going to block the breakdown of serotonin. And so you're basically like putting more gas in the gas tank with the 5-HTP, but you're not burning it because of the SSRI. And so it's very easy for you to develop serotonin syndrome if you're kind of, feeding the top of the funnel and not letting the bottom of the funnel burn the fuel, so to speak. So you don't want to take them together unless your psychiatrist specifically allows that, as making sure you're taking the right dosages of each. You may need to take, for instance, hypothetically, less of both doses if you're taking two together. You don't want to just throw more fuel to the fire. But as an alternative, you're talking about, what about taking 5-HTP as an alternative to an SSRI? First of all, again, talk to your psychiatrist or PCP that's prescribing it, because you don't want to necessarily all of a sudden discontinue psychiatric medication. Some people do have what's called an SSRI, like post-SSRI syndrome. They get withdrawal symptoms if you've been accustomed to taking an SSRI, particularly a high-dose SSRI. You can develop some withdrawal symptoms from that. So you don't want to necessarily quit cold turkey. Make sure that you're informing your provider that you're doing so. Now, if they've decided that it's safe for you to do so, sure, there are some supplements that you can try in terms of improving depression or mood. 5-HTP is one of them, but to be honest, I am not a particularly huge fan. I've never recommended it to folks. I personally think that if you're going to try to use a precursor, I think L-tryptophan is safer, potentially because L-tryptophan is a naturally occurring amino acid, right? You get L-tryptophan from protein powder. Any sort of protein source essentially has L-tryptophan to varying degrees. It's harder to overdo, quite frankly. You can't overdo anything, but if you're taking like a normal amount, which is typically typical dose of L-tryptophan is about 1,000 milligrams, it's very unlikely you're going to develop serotonin syndrome. However, with 5-HTP, it's much more potent. I think people take on the order of typically like 100 milligrams of it. But like I said, if you're taking other stuff, you're much more likely to screw around with your, you know, serotonin in a way that you're not trying to do. So my suggestion is, if you're going to go down that route, use L-tryptophan rather than 5-HTP. But again, consult with your provider to make sure that you're doing the right thing, that's a fit for your health. I do think there are other things that I think are particularly more helpful for depression if you're going down the supplement route. I actually talked about palmitol ethanolamide earlier in this show as an anti-inflammatory alternative to curcumin. It actually, interestingly, does have some benefits for depression as well. There's a inflammation hypothesis of depression, which says, maybe the serotonin hypothesis is not the main thing that drives depression. For a lot of people, it may actually be inflammation. And so there are some anecdotal reports that when people take anti-inflammatory drugs, they feel better, right? When they take an ibuprofen or a Tylenol, ironically, their mood improves if it seems to be their depression is mediated by inflammation. So depression does come with something called a sickness behavior. And if you think about it, a depressed person basically acts just like a sick person who has a cold or a flu. You don't want to go out. You don't want to socialize with your friends anymore. You kind of want to stay at home and recover. The unfortunate thing with depression is that becomes chronic, and the lack of stimulation, socialization, and exercise perpetuates depression. And so when you have a lot of inflammation that's going on, it may be that things like palmitol ethanolamide or PEA may be particularly helpful. The second category of sort of anti-inflammatories that I recommend is fish oil. Fish oil has a pretty strong evidence base for the improvement of mood. The problem with fish oil is the over-the-counter stuff is often very rancid, and you don't know the quality of it unless you're literally looking at each batch and making sure that it's not oxidized and smelling really fish oily. So there's a particular kind that I like that's higher quality. They're called pro-resolving mediators, or PRM. Life Extension, for instance, has it along with a couple other brands. But basically, it's highly filtered fish oil, and it concentrates these chemicals called pro-resolving mediators. These are actually chemicals that your body naturally makes in order to fight inflammation, especially when you have like a wound or a cut. These pro-resolving mediators aggregate at the site of the wound and help resolve it. So inflammation is not always a bad thing. In fact, acute inflammation is a good thing, right? When you get a sprained ankle or a cut, you want inflammation at the site in order to heal the injury. You just don't want it to chronically perpetuate, just like stress, because that accumulates sort of wear and tear. So I'm a fan of palmitoyl ethanolamide. I'm a fan of PRM, pro-resolving mediators type of fish oil. Those two in combination tend to really improve inflammation. And if you have the type of depression that's perpetuated or exacerbated by inflammation, those can be pretty promising, either adjuncts or potentially alternative treatments, if you will. The other thing that I've kind of been exploring lately is a new supplement called Selexin. Selexin is essentially a lavender oil extract. It's sold by two supplement companies here in the United States. One's Nature's Way and the other is Integrative Therapeutics. They're both owned by a German conglomerate called Schwab that produces this. You can go buy it on Amazon. But there's a bunch of studies that show that it's really good for anxiety. In fact, the effect size of it for treating generalized anxiety disorder is 0.86, which is phenomenally strong. By contrast, the SSRIs and SNRIs that we talked about previously had only an effect size of 0.33 to 0.36, which is small, right? So this, ironically, this over-the-counter supplement may be better for generalized anxiety than even the prescription stuff, which is remarkable and really rare. Generally, I think supplements are kind of useless for treating, you know, serious conditions. But this may be very early evidence, the exception to the rule. And so there is one study that I know of that has tested it for mixed anxiety and depression. Oftentimes, even though we understand anxiety and depression to be two separate things, obviously one is characterized by sadness, the other one's characterized by worry. These things tend to go hand in hand. Like 40% of people are both depressed and anxious at the same time. And so for that kind of mixed anxiety and depression, Selexin seems to have at least one study that suggests that it's actually pretty good treatment for it. And I think it's also particularly helpful for sleep, because if you have the type of insomnia that's driven by anxiety in particular, there was a very beautiful study that did a mediational analysis, basically showing that Selexin improves sleep. And that the variance of whether it was successful or not was basically accounted for by anxiety. And I think it was something like 98.4% of the variance was mediated by anxiety. So if you have, you know, a sleep disorder that's characterized by something else, like let's say a circadian rhythm dysfunction, you're jet lagged and that's why you're not sleeping, it's not going to help for that. But if it's mediated by, oh, I'm sitting in bed having worrisome thoughts and I can't go to bed because I'm anxious, then it's very helpful for that, in that it helps calm you down. What's remarkable about Selexin, though, is it doesn't seem to be a GABA agonist like the benzodiazepines. And so it doesn't create addiction or withdrawal like the benzos. It seems the primary mechanism of action is its calcium channel blocker. And so it doesn't create that tolerance or dependence that you see with sort of benzodiazepines, which are generally not safe, in my opinion, to be used on a chronic basis. So again, I'm not providing medical advice, but you can talk to your primary care provider or psychiatrist about Selexin. I think there's a pretty strong evidence base behind it. And consider that as an alternative, particularly if you have the type of depression that is comorbid with anxiety or you're having some sleep problems at the same time. It may be particularly helpful for that. So if someone asked me, like, what are the three supplements that I'd want to consider along with my physician, I would say palmitoyl ethanolamide, pro-resolving mediators, and Selexin would probably be my top three that I would consider, not 5-HTP. So sorry, that's a longer answer to your question, but hopefully, you know, it's helpful advice. And like I said, ultimately, it's not medical advice, but work with your PCP or psychiatrist to find what works for you.
No, that's super helpful. I think the more information, the better. And then there was one thing that you'd mentioned, which is not mixing an SSRI with 5-HTP, but how do you feel about mixing either, you know, an SSRI or one of the other kind of potential replacements with kind of this
off-brand use of oxytocin. So like in the low moments, even if you're on kind of the scheduled program of some sort of antidepressant, just using oxytocin as a kind of like, just a, like rather than caffeine, as like some sort of pick-me-up to get you through the day in certain situations. Do you feel like those two things shouldn't mix either?
I don't personally know of why oxytocin would be contraindicated for an SSRI. Although I'd want to like do a database search just to make sure that that's the case. The stuff that's obviously both serotonergic, right? Like 5-HTP, as we talked about, SSRI should obviously not be taken together. But yeah, you may want to consult with a pharmacist or a physician to make sure that oxytocin doesn't also have a contraindication. Is that something that you're getting prescribed? Because that's generally prescription.
Yeah, so I'm not getting prescribed with oxytocin, but I was curious about potentially getting it prescribed. I had seen that there was like some random like oxytocin sprays that you can get, but they all seem really shady. So I was like, okay,
yeah,
this is something that I could potentially get prescribed. But it just seems like, again, there's like just so much information for all these things that you could do. So it's just something that I was more so curious about, because I felt like, because I was looking at, you know, I guess what are some, you know, supplements or things that I get prescribed that can kind of pick you up, get you through the like the small moments. Like if you're pretty depressed, it's hard to function. So like, you know, medication for ADHD will help you, like, you know, get a bunch of shit done. And I was looking, I was kind of really interested in the effectiveness of kind of off-brand use of medications that will allow you to kind of function better. So that's why I was interested in oxytocin.
Yes. Yeah, great question. So for folks that are listening that may not be familiar with oxytocin, oxytocin, I like to call the love or the cuddle hormone. It's actually something that's naturally released by your body. Like for instance, when you hug people, when you cuddle with your partner, it's released during orgasm, and specifically when women breastfeed, it's released as well. The hypothesis is of course that it's related to pair bonding, right? That when you orgasm, you want to bond emotionally with your partner because you've probably inseminated or fertilized them. You don't want to run away as the father, or same thing as the mother. And same thing, obviously, if you're mother and child and you're breastfeeding, you want to pair bond essentially and kind of imprint the connection between mother and child. So it seems to be the hormone that's kind of responsible for that. Interestingly, in men, when you take it as a... So in women, it's actually interestingly used to induce labor. That's what it's FDA approved for. So you don't obviously want to take it if you're a pregnant woman, because it can induce, birth. But in men who are obviously don't deal with pregnancy, as controversial as it is to say that these days, shame on medical schools where that's not the case anymore. But in men, it actually enhances orgasm, right? Like I said, it's naturally released when you orgasm. So when you take some more supplementally, it actually makes it more intense. Which is pretty cool, kind of a performance enhancing effect, if you will. Now, I don't recommend buying it over the counter. There are some of these shady companies that are selling it, but who knows? Supplements are not regulated, and an oxytocin is a very delicate molecule. It's not something that can just sit around in a warehouse or on the shelf. Generally speaking, it needs to be refrigerated. So unless this company is cold shipping it to you in an ice pack, it's probably not oxytocin, or if it is, it's going to degrade and be worthless. I would generally only recommend oxytocin. You get it a prescription, because it is actually a prescription drug. You can typically get it as a troche. It's this little like gelatin, kind of like lozenge, and you kind of stick it under your tongue or in between your cheeks, and it'll dissolve and essentially will absorb sublingually under the tongue or buccally in your mouth. There's also basically an oral dissolving tablet or an ODT that you can get prescribed. And works the same way, gets absorbed sublingually or through the mouth. The thing is, the oral bioavailability of oxytocin is not very good. Like 90 to 95% of it probably gets wasted. That's why the preferred form is actually the intranasal form. It's a nasal spray that you squirt up your nose. That's really great if you know when you want to use it. So for instance, like I was saying, if you're taking it to enhance sex, then great. You pull it out of the fridge, you take two snorts up your nostrils, right before you have sex, and it's great for that. The reason for that, though, is the half-life of oxytocin is super short. It only lasts about 15 minutes. So that's perfect for sex, depending on how long you want to go. But if you're taking it for mood, obviously something that lasts 15 minutes is not going to give you a long-standing benefit that's going to be beneficial. The oral dissolving tablets, the dosages are like 10 to 20 times higher than the intranasal form. Intranasal, you might see something like 10 to 15 IUs or international units. With the oral dissolving tablets or the troches that I mentioned, you might see 100 to 200 IUs, right? Like I said, 10, even 20 times the dosage. The reason is, you know, 90% is being wasted. So in the end, it basically becomes the equivalent of the same amount. It comes down to like 10 to 15 IUs that's actually absorbed. So it actually does work well, despite what people say that the oral is not available. It's just not very bioavailable. If you, you know, do 10 times the dose, enough will trickle through that it does work. It's not a common treatment for depression, you know, it has been tested. I believe there's a paper back in 2010 that was looking at oxytocin in major depressive disorder. There's a negative correlation between sort of endogenous oxytocin that your body naturally produces and depression. So some people think, okay, well, if you're low in oxytocin, thus obviously taking it as a drug may, you know, alleviate symptoms of depression. So I don't think there's enough evidence base, quite honestly, to say that oxytocin would be an effective treatment for depression. I think it's been proposed, let's say, as a treatment for depression and anxiety, but I don't think there's as strong of an evidence base as opposed to, you know, like the classic SSRIs, where there's hundreds of studies, literally. I've seen it more commonly used for social cognition, autism, you know, other sorts of conditions where, you know, enhancing empathy and pair bonding, you know, is typically, I've seen like what the experiments are sort of used for. But look, if you want to take a very experimental approach, sure, talk to your psychiatrist or primary care physician about it. You know, and say, hey, like, can we try a non-serotonergic route? And can we try oxytocin? The good thing is, it may be compatible with an SSRI. I believe it has been used as an add-on. So it could be taken in potentially, like I said, I don't know, I haven't looked at the contraindications, but you could talk to them about whether adding it on to an existing treatment may also be an option as opposed to taking it instead of or as an alternative to an SSRI. So I just don't think we know much about it, but there's not a lot of side effects from my understanding of oxytocin compared to other drugs. It's relatively benign, I would say. But, you know, it does have like these different kind of cognitive and social effects. You know, I think you may just have to kind of try it and see how it works for you. But I think it's an interesting idea. But like I said, you should consider it. It is an off-label experimental use. There's not a lot of evidence behind it. But, you know, it has some social benefits, I would say. Oxytocin generally makes you feel more socially attuned with people, a little more empathic. Like I said, better, more bonding if you have a primary partner, and makes sex better. So, you know, in that regard, it's a pretty cool drug.
Awesome. Everything super helpful. Thank you so much for answering that.
Absolutely. Best wishes with what you're facing. I know it's super tough. Like, you know, I almost feel like it's kind of a tragedy that patients have to almost like take a little bit of responsibility and do what you're doing, which is playing Dr. Google and trying to find solutions for themselves. You know, here's the good news though, is when you find a good provider, I think you'll have to do less of that. Like, I don't think that responsibility should be on you to go research everything. Like, look, you are in charge of your own health in the end, but that's why it's really helpful to, you know, work with a good provider. I don't think it's a bad thing to go with hypotheses, right? And say, hey, look, I've heard about this oxytocin thing, read a couple studies, but look, I'm not an expert. You are. Like, what do you think about it? Some folks may be more open-minded and be like, all right, sure, let's try it. Just like we try anything else, and can work with you. Some folks are going to be a little bit more by the book and they're going to be like, hey, you know what? It's an interesting idea. I don't have a lot of evidence to support this. I haven't used it personally, so I don't know if I'm particularly comfortable with it. So why don't we try some other stuff that we know works, or I have a lot more experience with. And I don't think that's to say that they're closed-minded. I think any clinician who's evidence-based is going to want to try stuff that, you know, has a higher likelihood of working because there's more research behind it. Once you've kind of tried a lot of things and it's really not working, then sure, you can get more experimental. But I think most responsible and conservative clinicians are going to want to try, you know, bread and butter stuff, and really exhausting those options before you get too crazy with the experimental stuff. So I think that's a logical point of view, but you may need to kind of find a provider that essentially will work with you. And that, yeah, you don't have to take on the responsibility of playing researcher.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you saying that. It's definitely, I gave that exact thing some thought where I was like, man, I don't know how anyone else that would have it like worse than I do would be able to kind of like manage this tornado storm of information just to, you know, quite frankly, achieve something which should be relatively simple, which is happy. So yeah, it's a shitty thing, but it is what it is.
I feel you, man. I wish that were the case and that happiness was a simple thing. I think partly that's true in the sense that I think if you really invest in your health and really take care of yourself, happiness does get easier is the way that I put it. Like if your diet is on point, you're sleeping 7 to 9 hours a night. Like and by diet being on point, I mean like, you know, like let's say 80% of your stuff is like non or minimally processed food. That's the best marker of a healthy diet, in my opinion. You're getting 7 to 9 hours of sleep. You're doing 30 minutes of strength training at least 3 to 5 times a week. You're walking 7,500 plus steps a day. You are minimizing your social media use to less than an hour and general media use to less than an hour a day. And you're spending at least an hour of really like quality time with either, you know, a friend or a significant partner. So you're getting the quality social time and avoiding loneliness. If you're doing all of those things, it's not a guarantee that you'll be happy, but boy, will that increase your odds a lot significantly. Because I think a lot of what drives people's depression is quite frankly, a lack of self-care. And obviously when you're depressed, it makes it even harder to go do those things. That's the weird catch 22, right? It's like, we do know that for instance, exercise has a mild beneficial effect on depression and moderate beneficial effect on anxiety, but it's the last thing you want to do when you're depressed. So it's the chicken and the egg problem. But that does go a long way. But I think the other part of it is, man, we just live in a society that's not designed for happiness, right? It's an ultra competitive, highly hyper individualistic society. And also I would argue our brains and genetics are not optimized for happiness. We're optimized for to survive. Your brain is a threat detection machine, right? And it's going out there and looking for problems that may be a threat to your health. So I actually would argue that the point of life is not to be happy, as unpopular and as contrarian of a thesis as that is. I don't think we're designed for it, and nor are our environments are optimized for it. And actually, I will go even one last step further. I actually think the pursuit of happiness, as un-American as this may sound, is what makes Americans miserable. If you're really interested in going down the rabbit hole of this thesis, I highly recommend a book to everyone called The Happiness Trap. It's written by a colleague of mine named Dr. Russ Harris. And he actually argues that the pursuit of happiness makes us unhappy because if you're not happy, now you're also unhappy about not being happy because that's your expectation in the first place. So not only are you generally like unhappy, but now you're like meta unhappy because you're like, that's not the way things should be. So you basically have suffering that's on top of your pain, right? And even when you are happy, you're worried like on the Sunday scaries, oh man, how long is this happiness going to last before it disappears on Monday morning? And, you know, I'm worried about, you know, becoming depressed again. So as opposed to like playing this game, which he calls the happiness trap, you shift your purpose in life to, it's not about the pursuit of happiness. It's about the pursuit of meaning, and meaning is not an emotion. Contentment is a cognitive appraisal. It's an appraisal that you're saying, you know what? I'm satisfied with my life because I'm spending it, my time in a way that's aligned with my core values, with the things that are fundamentally important to me, regardless of whether, quite frankly, I feel sad, happy, anxious, or not worried. All of those things will come and go. And the best analogy that I make is like being a parent will not make you happy. In fact, there's studies that show that if you randomly page parents, they're less happy when they spend time with their children. As terrible as that sounds. But it's the truth, right? Nobody really enjoys changing a diaper. But the reason that people do it anyway, and almost all parents say they don't regret having children, even though it does make them less happy objectively, is it creates great meaning and purpose in their life, right? It's quite meaningful to bring another human being into the world, even if it doesn't make you happy. And the reason we all, most people still do it anyway, is because that's, well, A, our biological purpose on Earth, but B, it is quite meaningful to live for something greater than you. And I think when you start living for not happiness, but a meaning-driven life, a values-based life, it makes it okay to occasionally have sadness and worry and all those things. They're not pathological. They're part of the human condition. This is basically the foundation of ACT, or what's called acceptance and commitment therapy, which is the type of therapy that I practice as a psychologist and train psychiatrists in to practice themselves as a form of psychotherapy. I find it particularly helpful because then, like I said, it's not about the pursuit of happiness, but it's more about living a rich, meaningful, and fulfilling life, which I think you can always do, but you can't control your happiness. And I think, quite frankly, it's fruitless to try. So check that out. It's called The Happiness Trap by Russ Harris.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. It's like the flow theory, which is like the whole idea is like chasing happiness will make you unhappy. Mm-hmm. That's what it reminds me a lot of. And I would also maybe potentially make the argument that you are right in the sense that this environment is not conducive to people being happy. But I would also, you know, I would maybe push the argument that in other countries with other cultures, like, you know, mm-hmm. Back home in the Middle East or, you know, quite frankly, in the UK, some parts of it, you know, the environment is very conducive for people kind of just, you know, working briefly and then going out and enjoying their lives, spending time with family. And you find, like, you know, kind of a higher happiness spectrum over there. But yeah, totally. I know I've commandeered so much of this time, but hopefully it was super helpful to everyone else as it was to me. So yeah, I really appreciate everything you said.
Absolutely. No, I actually enjoy doing deep diving and almost like a little bit more coaching rather than answering questions. So you're not taking too much time at all. No, and I agree. There's a great quote that I always repeat by Krishnamurti, who says it's no, let me make sure I get this right. It's no measure of health to be well-adjusted to a profoundly sick society. And I think it's such a condemnation of our society, right? We stigmatize people with depression. I'm like, oh, it's like a failure of your ability to thrive, when really it's not, right? You know, the best, I always share this story. I was watching this documentary about people who have like internet gaming disorder, who are addicted to video games. Which is really common. I think like half of Gen Z is probably addicted to, whether it's video games or social media, which, by the way, there's no difference between the two. Twitter is an anger video game, is the way that I always describe it. It's a giant, massively multiplayer online role-playing game in which you accumulate points by the number of followers that you get and retweets that you get. It's a game. It's just a big social game. There's no difference between a video game and Twitter. People are just as addicted to it, myself included. So, you know, when you're in a society that's essentially like addiction is almost the norm, it is very hard to be well adjusted, quite frankly, because there's always temptation, whether that's literally through drugs that are addictive or devices or programs. And I don't think there's actually that much of a difference between the two besides the physiological withdrawal. They're all forms of emotional avoidance or escapism. And in fact, ACT really like points that out, that it's not depression that's the problem. It's not anxiety that's the problem. It's everything that we do to avoid it that's the problem, right? It's when we withdraw that depression becomes spirals down, or when we avoid with anxiety that it actually becomes a problem. But if we feel sadness or we feel worry and we still are able to lead rich, meaningful, fulfilling lives, do everything that we're able to do, go to work, be responsible, you know, to our families, do you really have a problem? No. So we shouldn't necessarily pathologize the emotion. It's the functioning that's really the issue there. And then, yeah, to your last point about, you know, the UK and the Middle East, you know, being more conducive to happiness, that may be true. I really think like the people underestimate the social aspect of depression, right? We are not like no man is an island, as they say. And I think the hyper-individualism and competitiveness of American society basically means that like the people on top are happy, the people who have made it, quote unquote, ultra successful, ultra rich, By the way, money does buy happiness. There is interesting research that shows there's two kind of competing theses. There's like one that it doesn't buy happiness, or at least there's diminishing marginal utility once you make over $75,000 a year in the average American city, or about, let's say, $125,000 in a more expensive American city. There's some new research that suggests it actually may increase happiness. But it's not that necessarily it's the money that's buying happiness. To me, it's that, like, if you manage to be ultra wealthy in the society, man, you're a resilient person, because to, you know, run a company or manage a high profile job as a white collar job, you have to almost not be depressed. So because how do you tolerate 50, 60, 70 hour work days and still go on without falling apart? You have to kind of be a resilient individual. So unfortunately, like, it is very survival of the fittest in American society and culture, in that the strong survive and quite frankly thrive, and they get a disproportionate amount of the wealth and maybe even the happiness. While I think in other cultures, to your point, you don't necessarily need to be on top to be happy. You just need, you know, enough to live. A lot of those cultures are like not live to work like in the US, but they work to live. And as long as you have your basic needs met and you have a very rich social life, it's more conducive to happiness, because honestly, that's what makes people more happy anyway. I think the quality of your, if I had to like analyze someone or assess someone, I should say, and try to predict without asking them directly, are you depressed or not? You can pretty much judge it by the quality of their relationships. Interestingly, like, I'll give you an example. When I do individual work with clients, I ask them four questions every single week in order to assess their well-being. This is a validated scale. It's called the ORS, or Outcomes Rating Scale. I ask them like about their individual or personal well-being, right? That's fair. But then the three other things I ask about their interpersonal well-being. I'm like, in terms of your, you know, like family and romantic relationships, how's that kind of well-being, right? And then I ask about their social occupational well-being in terms of your relationships with your friends and colleagues. How is that? And then I ask them about their general overall well-being. But it's interesting that two out of the four questions that I ask people in order to assess their weekly well-being are social in nature, about friendships, colleagues, family, romantic partners. Because that pretty much, that is half of happiness, if you will, in my opinion. So the moral of the story is, I don't think you need to move to Europe or the Middle East if you're an American in order to find happiness. But maybe there are some things that we can learn from those cultures, especially if you come from those cultures ethnically, that are useful, quite frankly, right? And I think it's important to not have excessive hubris that the American way is the best way. Maybe it is for innovation. I think we kick ass on that department, but we're not the best in terms of happiness or satisfaction. And so I really think if you are listening out there, investing in your relationships is by far probably the best investment that you can make in terms of having a rich, meaningful, and fulfilling life. There's a really, if you're interested in this particular subject, I would Google the Harvard 75-year study. They followed a group of Harvard alums, literally 75 years from the time they graduated at 22 to, you know, up until they died, or at least survived to 97 years old, and looked at essentially what promotes thriving. And they found basically it wasn't like the degree of their success, it was the quality of their relationships that really was the main predictor in how long you lived, your quantity of life, but also your quality of life, which is what we call health span as opposed to lifespan. So don't negate that either. I know we spent a lot of time talking about supplements and pharmacology. That is important too, but, you know, loneliness is by far the biggest predictor of mortality, even over a lot of like biomarkers that we look at. And so if that's the case, take a hard look at your relationships and what you can do to bolster those and your social connection. And sure, yeah, you can use stuff like oxytocin to maybe enhance your social relationships, but you got to be investing and spending time with people in the first place in order to do that. Like I said, it'll enhance orgasm, but if you don't have a partner, it's not going to be as enjoyable. So on that note, if you're really trying to, you know, lead a rich, meaningful, and fulfilling life, by far investing in your relationships is a worthwhile thing to do. I know it's almost like common sense, but as I like to say, common sense ain't so common these days. And so if I can provide a friendly reminder to people to do that, then do it. And, you know, here's the thing. I do think there's nothing like having, I always call it like a handful of close friends. You don't need a lot of friends, by the way. I think this is a totally misunderstood American thing. Maybe it's because we have thousands of followers on Instagram or Facebook, quote unquote, friends. It's all bullshit. Most people only have 1 to 2 people that they talk to on a daily basis outside of their family. And those 1 to 2 people are their significant other, if they have one, and a best friend. That's it. 1 to 2 people. And then they have 4 to 6 people that they talk to on a weekly basis. Those are their close friends, their squad, if you will, to use Gen Z parlance. And yeah, you want people that basically you can shoot the shit with on a weekly basis, without any particular reason or agenda to call you. Like, a good litmus test is how many friends do you have you can call up for no particular reason, just to talk to them and hang out. That's a good, and especially on a weekly basis. That's a good sign that they're a real friend. If you can find those 1 to 2 plus 4 to 6 people, that's basically like 4 to 7 friends, or what I call a handful. It's about 5 on average. That's all you need. And obviously, you know, if you have family, spending time with them, and ideally one of them is a significant other, that's all the relationships that you need in order to be happy and thrive. Everyone else is an acquaintance. And it doesn't mean don't invest in your professional networks. That's great for career reasons. And yes, there are maybe some old, you know, people you went to school with or some colleagues that you want to catch up with every once in a while. That's fair. Don't ignore them. But, you know, keeping in touch with folks on a daily to weekly basis that you can have deep, intimate relationships with, and which there's emotional intimacy, vulnerability, and instrumental support, meaning like, will they pick you up from an airport or help you move, right? That's also a good litmus test of a real friend. Those are the real relationships that are going to move the needle in terms of your life satisfaction. Otherwise, you run into this American phenomenon of the person who's always surrounded with people, right? And even the people they're friendly with, but they're not their friends. So they're socializing a lot, but when they come home at the end of the day, they still feel lonely. And that's the interesting thing that the psych research has found. It's not the number of friends or the robustness of your social network that predicts mortality. It's the subjective feeling of loneliness, right? So like I said, if you're the CEO surrounded by a bunch of people, but you're coming home alone at night and you feel alone, right? That's the best predictor. It's the feeling of loneliness. So like I said, invest in your 4 to 7 friends or your handful of close friends. Ride or die is a good litmus test. Are these people ride or die? You know, would bury a body for you? Not that you should be ever in that position, but you get what I mean in terms of the level of having your back. And I think that it honestly will make a bigger determinant of your happiness and meaning than any drug, any supplement, and maybe even any health behavior, right? I would actually argue that is going to be a better than even diet, exercise, maybe sleep, than anything. Obviously you should do those things too, but the social aspect, we're such social creatures and it makes such a big difference in terms of our happiness and our meaning. So don't underestimate it. And thank you for letting me beat that dead horse.
No, I love it. I think you're absolutely right about like the meaning for relationships. And at first I was going to interject and say, are you prioritizing a romantic relationship? But I love the fact that you prioritize kind of this whole idea of like the blood brother. And I think, right. I think it was you,
right,
that even made the analogy that it was like, historically, mm-hmm, you actually couldn't have more than, I think there was like 3 or 4 blood,
exactly,
because you didn't have the capacity for that. And I think prioritizing this kind of small circle of like blood brothers will actually be able to, quite frankly, I think even enhance your relationship, your romantic relationships, because if you don't have them and you kind of put all your eggs in one basket in this romantic relationship, then that dependency becomes too much to handle. And I think all of like, you put all of your needs on one person and there's never going to be one person that can meet all of your needs. So diversifying that across, you know, really, really good relationships is super helpful. Relationships are super important. I think, there's more things I could say on it, but again, I've taken up so much time here.
You brought up really like universal themes, and it's been useful because then I think it appeals to everyone who's listening. I don't think there's a single listener on Clubhouse that doesn't want a more rich, meaningful, and fulfilling life. So even though we started out on SSRIs and, you know, 5-HTP, I think it's become very generalizable. For the folks that are listening, what Rehan's alluding to is I had a thread on Twitter that actually talks about this. It's a really interesting historical cultural reference in that in the Scythians had this concept of blood brothers. So you might have heard the old story that, you know, in, the ritual is you cut your arm, you know, your wrist, and you bind your wrists together as a symbolic gesture that you're fused, just as like a brother is who shares your blood, so to speak. You know, obviously that's not as safe to do these days in terms of bloodborne diseases, so don't do that. But the interesting thing is they didn't allow you to have more than three blood brothers at a time. And the reason for that was you couldn't essentially prove your loyalty if you had too many oaths to fulfill. Like, because being a blood brother was a big deal back then. Like, that meant, like, if you died in war, who's going to take care of your wife and children? Your blood brother would. It's almost like a godparent these days. And so, yeah, three max. And so, ironically, guys would almost like court their blood brothers. Like, you date them, kind of, not romantically, but you'd almost go through this interview process to be like, do I trust this motherfucker with my wife and children if I died? Right? And that's the seriousness in which they would make these oaths. And it would be a lifelong kind of commitment. Now, I don't know if we need to go to that extreme, but it is a very telltale sign of, like, do you have three people that you trust that if you passed away, they would take care of your affairs, your estate, or your loved ones, quite frankly. And if you don't have anyone, get to work on that. Ideally, you would want, you know, at least one person, ideally three, that could provide that for you. And to Rehan's point, I don't think anything substitutes for a romantic relationship, but the reality is it takes time to find a romantic relationship, particularly one that's aligned and long-term. So for a lot of guys, you're going to spend some time being single. And it's not to say that you can't be happy or have meaning in your life without a romantic relationship. I do think optimal happiness and meaning does come from having a primary monogamous romantic relationship. But in the meantime, you can go a long way. If you have those couple close friends, blood brothers, etc., you can have a very, very rich life. And to your point, it'll probably enhance the likelihood of having a successful romantic relationship because you won't be overly dependent on them, particularly for the emotional intimacy. Obviously, you shouldn't be getting physical intimacy from your best friends, but the emotional intimacy is actually, I would argue, can be as strong, if not distinct, from your romantic partner. A lot of guys make the mistake of dumping too much on their romantic partner, their girlfriend or wives, in terms of their emotional needs, when quite frankly, they should be discussing some of those things with their therapist, their psychologist, or their best friends, and or their best friends. Because, you know, it's not necessarily, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't disclose things to your partner. You should absolutely be vulnerable. I always say vulnerability, intimacy is shared vulnerability. But, you know, if you're talking about your worries and your stresses, that can obviously stress your partner out, especially if you're seen as the provider of the relationship, the leader, the guider, if you believe in more traditional relationship mores. And so excessively doing that can sometimes cause stress, right? There is something called affect contagion, which is just a fancy word where feelings are contagious. If you're anxious, stressed, worried, and you're talking about that with your partner, it does transmute to some degree. They're going to start to feel anxious, stressed, worried as well. So it doesn't mean you can't ever do it, but you want to be mindful of how much you share, how much you disclose, and how much you put that burden on the other person. You have to find the happy medium. It's not obviously never sharing, but it may not be 100% either. I don't believe in radical honesty, actually, to have successful relationships. It really does behoove you to have a psychologist and or some best friends that you can talk to about some close stuff. Also, if you're having some relationship issues, it's also good to have a third party to talk about that because, you know, you should talk about it with your partner, but you need to also talk with an objective third party about how you might approach talking to your partner about particular relationship issues. So they're very complementary and important. Develop your friendships outside of your romantic relationships as well. Thank you everyone for really, really stimulating conversation. I know we had a very expansive topic as we talked about supplements, prescription drugs, social relationships, and everything in between. But I think it's such a good example of that's really what health requires. You know, true health, in my opinion, you know, spans the psychological, the social, the behavioral, and the physiological. And you have to kind of take care of yourself on all those needs because we are mind, body, spiritual creatures, if you will. And being holistic is really the key to good health. So if you're interested in more in finding out about what we do as a company, check us out at MaximusTribe.com. As I mentioned, we're a men's telemedicine company that does prescription hormone optimization, specifically doubling men's testosterone through prescription medication supplements and coaching. And if you're just interested in the coaching aspect of it, you can join our community. That part is free. You can go to discord.maximustribe.com, and Discord is a web app or mobile app you can download. We have a channel there called hashtag coaching in particular, in which we do daily and weekly accountability on diet, exercise, sleep, focus, and relationships. So if you're looking for greater social connection, that's a great way of doing that while having, you know, your buddies push you to make sure you're doing your regular exercise and getting enough sleep and all that good stuff. So feel free to follow up and join us on the Discord. We have a lot of other channels as well where you can talk about everything from parenting to pharmaceuticals. All right, that's our time for this week. Thank you everyone for joining us, especially those of you joining us on our original channel on Discord. Thanks for everyone who's joining us on Instagram Live and YouTube Live. And thanks to all of our loyal listeners on Clubhouse. We'll be back every single Thursday, 7 o'clock Pacific. If you want to submit some questions in advance, you can do so on social media. Just send me a DM. I'm easy to find. My handle's the same on Twitter, Instagram, all those places. It's Dr. Cam RX, DrCamRx. And we can prioritize those questions. Otherwise, call in next Thursday at 7 and I will chat through with you live. All right. Thanks, everyone. Have a wonderful, happy, and blessed Thursday. Catch you next week.